Murka attempts to sing his love song to the window of his beloved, Hansok starts pounding with his hammer on his shoes, creating such a din that the poor Murka does not know what he's doing. And finally, Beckmesser goes and complains, and Hansok says, "But it's your shoes I am mending. You have said you must have them, and quickly. So you are going to have them quickly." Poor Beckmesser then says, "Well, don't have them now, because I'm trying to sing." But Hansok says he has to do the shoes. It's part of the deal. So finally they arbitrate. Hansok says that he will not nail the shoe except when Beckmesser makes a mistake in his music, and Sock will play the part of the Murka and mark down the errors. And of course it so develops that the errors are almost continuous, and before the song is nearly finished, the entire pair of shoes has been repaired because of the number of mistakes. Poor Beckmesser is by this time nearly hysterical. He jumps up and down, shouts and screams, and acts in a manner appropriate to the comedy relief of the situation. The story unfolds in this way through the simple activities of the people of the community. And there is the gradual integration of the great so-called prize song, which young Walter is said to have received in a dream. There is some temporary misunderstanding between Eva and Hansok, but this is cleared up, and the scene more or less moves around the house of the kindly cobbler or shoemaker. And young Walter, before the next competition, which is to take place, sings parts of his song to Hansok in the shop. Hansok very carefully makes notations on a piece of paper of certain things that he thinks are particularly fine. And young Walter will not sing the climax of his song, because he says that he will only sing when he is doing it for the competition. So the young man goes off to get dressed to go out and join the parade of the guildsmen. And in the interlude of a comparatively quiet stage, Beckmesser comes in and sees the manuscript with the notes of Hansok laying on the table. He looks at it, and he sees that it is a musical composition. He does read music well enough to know that it is excellent, and he immediately decides to appropriate it for himself. So he slips the manuscript leaves in his pocket, and about this time Hansok comes in. And Beckmesser begins to deride Hansok for having written a love song, and insists that he is going to try, as this cobbler is going to try, to take Eva away from him, Beckmesser, at the competition. Sock does not know what it's all about. It's a complete mystery to him until he notices that the manuscript is missing. Then the thing clears instantly. So Sock assures Beckmesser that he is not going to compete, that he's not going to take Eva away from him. In fact, he's not even going to sing the song. And under these conditions, he will even let Beckmesser sing it for him, so that Beckmesser can have this song, which almost certainly should win the fair lady. Well, now Beckmesser is jumping up and down in glee. He is almost hysterical for joy now. His peculiar fitting clothes, which are exaggerated for the occasion, are sticking out in all directions, and he is just like a jumping jack out of sheer joy at this situation. So he now feels almost certain that he's going to win, but of course old Hansok knew the facts, knew exactly how it was going to turn out, and was not much concerned over the entire problem. And then of course comes a delightful scene on the banks of the river outside of the city of Nuremberg. Here we find the guilds gathering, and there are great parades, and Wagner introduces a delightful chorus with a waltz, which had not been invented at the time, by the way, but that doesn't interfere with the high drama any more than the introduction of a clock's striking is notable in the play of Julius Caesar, in which clocks did not exist, but that is a poetic or dramatic license. But you have an interesting scene in the last act of the Meistersingers where the guilds parade in. And this is really, they come in with their banners and their various brilliant costumes and all the equipment and all the festivities of the occasion. They make grand march and everything, and they form a great ring of people. And the villagers are all there, and the children are all there, and theoretically, if not factually, the local animals are all there. It is the great day. Everyone turns out. And in the midst of this, of course, the rich burghers appear, including the goldsmith and his beautiful daughter, and they have a stand, or sort of a grandstand, up stage left, where they sit to watch what is happening. And everyone is in a very festive and wonderful mood. And in the midst of all of this festivities, Beckmesser decides that it is his opportunity to sing the song that is going to win for him the Fair Eva. He's only made two or three slight errors, however. One thing, he forgot to memorize it, so that he does not really know the song. In fact, he got it so recently, he had very little time to do anything with it. The second thing was that he had not learned how to unite the words and the music. And he was in a pretty bad state by the time he started to try to sing this. And so with the notes at which he is peering at most unfortunate moments, and which he is reading in wrong arrangement, he sort of cries and shouts and gurgles and garbles, but very little comes out that is of any value musically. And before he gets through, the entire group of persons around, all the judges and everyone else, are laughing uproariously at him, ridiculing him, and he is informed that he has not only broken all the rules that there are in the tabulator, but he has broken rules that were never up to that time invented even. So that he is in total and complete disgrace. Now actually, young Walther is not a master of the order because his first effort had failed. And theoretically, he was not entitled to compete at this time. But through the intercession of Hans Sack, who is always there to do things, Sack explains that Beckmesser had badly misused the music composed by another person. Therefore, that in fairness to the composition and all concerned, that the true author should be permitted to present his melody and to be judged accordingly. That actually it was not fair otherwise that the thing should be. So in due course, young Walther stands out on the little mound in the middle of the stage where the master singer sings his number and sings his prize song. And at the end of the prize song, the music, although it is not quite traditional, Hans Sack saves the situation by pointing out certain values and pointing out throughout that perhaps this music must be measured by its own internal laws and not simply by the rules in a book. That there is another kind of rule, the rule within the structure of music. And that if this rule is kept, if the real and great rules of harmony are preserved, that there may be other catalogues of values by which these things should be determined. Of course, Hans Sack has such a venerable position that no one really wants to go against him. So he is accepted, his conclusion is accepted, and Walther, of course, is pronounced the winner. He receives the wreath, but refuses the chain which goes with it because of the previous rebuff at the time of his first musical appearance before the master singers. When he refuses this honor, Hans Sack speaks to him and tells him that he must not refuse, that he must recognize that there were rules which he did not keep, that the new situation that arose and the honor that these people now wish to convey upon him, he should accept in proper and gracious spirit. And as long as he is also getting Eva in the bargain, he decides that that is the best thing to do. It is then that Hans Sack sings his great song on the glory of the guilds and of the folk, telling not only the story of the master singers and all that they stood for and the great trade unions of Germany, but prophetically warning of the dangers that lay ahead for the country when these great unifying factors were no longer venerated and admired. This is such a moving song that at the end of it, Walther takes the wreath of the winner from his own head and places it on that of Hans Sachs. There is general and complete rejoicing. The goldsmith is satisfied with his new son-in-law, and everything ends on a note of very constructive and happy circumstances. This is approximately the story of the opera. There are the details, the apprentices and so on, but they do not add much to the color of the story. Here, then, we have the remnant of the old Minnesan. Walther is actually singing this song to win his bride. And while the contrivance is a little different from the older contrivance, again, Eva represents the soul toward which the great song is sung. Again, Hans Sachs is old Gernemons of Parsifal. He is Merlin, the wise man. He is the counselor. He is the old way of wisdom. He is the initiator and the guide and the leader in this curious adventure which is to befall. Young Walther is again the hero of the world. He is the one who is to win his own soul through fair and reasonable competition, to be judged by a jury of his kind, and is to earn his right to be included within the great circle of the master singers. The master singers, of course, representing mature human beings, the citizens of the tribe or nation, the responsible persons in society to which the individual must earn, in which he must earn his place. And I think we have another interesting phase of this which comes down to us from old times, and that is that these degrees, the 3 degrees of the master singer's order and the 3 steps of the guild builder's order, all relate to the essential values of citizenship in the ancient tribe of peoples. In antiquity, man was never born into citizenship. He had to earn it. He was always advanced through 3 stages, from childhood to adolescence, from adolescence to maturity. In childhood, he was the one who wrote the poem but could not write the music. In adolescence, he wrote the music but not the words. But in maturity, he wrote both the music and the words. In other words, he combined the soul or the musical factor, the spiritual or invisible, with the words which represented the outer forms of things. Thus he became the complete builder of a compound structure of spirit and body, represented by the song and the words. In ancient times, young people, both boys and girls, had to pass through certain tests before they could become citizens. These tests are contrived or preserved to us to some degree in the examinations of a university. Here again, committee is appointed. The individual is assigned certain responsibilities and duties. These he must perform. But in the old times, these initiation rites usually represented 3 important steps. First, in childhood, he had to practice obedience and learning. In adolescence, he had to develop skill and knowledge. And in maturity, he had to accept responsibility. These were the degrees of his order. And when the time came for him to compete to be a master, that is, to become a full-fledged citizen, it was necessary for him to prove achievement. No one was permitted in ancient society to full citizenship in his clan, in his tribe, in his state, or in his nation until he could bring to that society a proven skill by means of which he could contribute to the well-being of the group. No individual at that time belonged to a leisure class. There wasn't any. No individual was permitted to live off of the group. No individual was permitted to live only by barter and exchange within the group. And this was an important rule of the Essene sect in Syria and the Lebanon. Every citizen must be a creative producer. He must actually contribute a positive and purposeful, useful trade or craft to the security of the group. So his initiation ended with his proof under trial, his ability to prove that he was a master. Until he could prove this, he could not sit in the council of his elders, nor could he make rules or participate in any legislation, nor could he pass ballot or vote. He could have no authority until he had passed his examination. And by this examination, he convinced his elders that they could depend upon him to be a useful creator, making a positive contribution to the physical well-being of his group. This record concept was carried also in the story of the Master Singers. But now we have a new dimension coming. The guilds, the clothers, the tailors, the barbers, the merchants, the hatters, all of these groups contributed something to the comfort, security, protection, and efficiency of life. But there was something else. A man lives not by bread alone, nor with a good pair of new shoes alone. Because a man may have all the comforts and commodities of life and still be unhappy. He can still be frustrated, and he can be without internal equilibrium, in internal well-being. So the Minasang and later the Master Singers came in as the over-guild in which individuals had to prove the maturity of the soul. Now this was a very important thing. And in these guilds, the maturity of the soul was proved on the level of music. In other words, if the individual could by instinct and nature produce beauty, his soul was good. He did not have to know music, technically. Because instinctively, if he was an integrated being, he would combine tone in a way, simply because he could not endure it any other way himself. If, however, his instincts were not mature, if his psychic discrimination was not developed, he would not notice inharmony, or would accept it without question, or would not discriminate. And his condition, of course, is intimated in the case of Beckmesser, who never knew that he was no good. But if the individual instinctively moves in harmonic pattern, you have something that is very important, and I think we come across it strongly and dramatically in Oriental art. You do not have to be an artist to understand art, but you have to have a soul. You do not have to be a musicologist to enjoy music, but you will find that as you become accustomed to music, your taste will change. You will become more and more capable of appreciating music which at one previous time was beyond your comprehension. You will find that your taste for good music gradually unfolds. And you will also know why certain great composers have lived, even though you might not instinctively react to them. Ultimately, the musical maturity of a people elevates its musically great to the state and the condition to which they are entitled. And great musicians, gradually unfolding their own internal consciousness, come to certain common agreement as to what constitutes true greatness. In this way, the Minnesang and the Meistersingers became the soul artisans. They had to do with the release of the overtones in human nature, man's creativity on a psychic level. The individual is never completely creative if he labors only with his hands. The work of his hands is necessary and needed by his people. But a civilization without poets will never mature, and a culture without philosophers will die. There must be these overtones, and the stout, solid burghers of Germany experience this tremendous need for overtone. We experience it today, but we do not know what to do about it. We realize that our materialism is not correct, and most of us are desperately lacking in the opportunity for psychic creativity. We are no longer capable of doing things with the wonderful ingenuity which marked the habits and practices of our ancestors. Perhaps there is no place where this is more obvious, no time, than right now at Christmas. 100 years ago, very few people ever bought a gift. It would have been regarded as something almost a disgrace. Today, very few people make one. Also today, very few people who would make one and give it would be appreciated. Because today we live in a world of store-bought fineries of all kinds. And unless it is machine-made, we do not consider it to be good. We're a little ashamed of the things we make with our own hands. And yet, because we are so deprived, there is rising all over the world craft shops, backyard carpenter shops, little neighborhood activities where individuals make things, do things themselves because of the great and pressing need for human expression. The expression that no individual can have unless he recognizes, as Hans Sachs tells us in one of his prose works, that no man, no human being is mature unless he expresses through himself the divine impulse to create. He must make something. He must fashion it. He must put it together. And most of all, he must have and create dreams. He must have visions within himself. He does not need to be a visionary person, but he must be a person with vision. He must have an opportunity to release beauty. Draw, paint, sing, play. He must do these things himself. Sitting at the piano with one finger of each hand and trying to work out some simple melody means more in creativity within the individual than the purchase of $500 worth of symphonic records which he can listen to and do nothing. No, he does not mean that he shouldn't listen. But there is a strange victory in the doing. And it may be so badly done that no one will enjoy it but you. And the neighbors will hope you move. And yet inside of yourself, the thing that you do is yours. The thing that you only listen to or watch somebody else do is not yours. And this was the spirit behind the Meistersingers. That these people had to release soul through action. We have to. And the soul is harmony, order, number. The soul is rhythm, pattern, design. And it is the soul in man which, coming forth, resolves to make the world beautiful. And in this struggle toward beauty, we find many degrees, many limitations, many barriers. but the bursting through of the soul of a people in its art and in its culture announces the maturity of that people. Thus, the glory of the folk is expressed through the glory of the guilds, the creative bands of artisans who worship through work and who honor God through creativity, through becoming themselves creators of beauty. Therefore, today, every modern person bound within a circle of humdrum experiences should have this creative outlet by decision, by choice, by the recognition of necessity. He should make things with his hands. He should dream things. He should learn to express the inner psychic power of his own nature. And perhaps today that is why we have so many organizations now springing up, weavers. And the effect of weaving alone upon the restoration of health among battle fatigue victims is tremendous. Weaving for backward children has shown that creativity, to do something, releases power. The making of pottery, the designing of fabrics, the making of furniture, all of these things are perhaps not too important in term end of production, but they are tremendously important in helping man to break through the mechanical routine of life which carries him from the cradle to the grave without self-expression, without self-satisfaction of instinct. Where this neurotic pressure of limitation settles upon the individual, his health, his character, his affability, all these things suffer. So perhaps we need the guilds back. Perhaps we need the simple rituals of the guilds and the tremendous experience of ritualism. Because ritualism is again a union in action, like the cyclic dances of the ancient Greeks. The dance again is the union of man and motion. And this is a tremendous experience. This is why so much emphasis was placed upon it by the Orphics and also by the Muslim mystic Jalaluddin, who declared that the rhythms of the body, if brought into harmony with the rhythms of the universe, represent a kind of illumination, a tremendous psychic experience of motion. In India, we have the mantram and the mudra. The mudra is a hand posture, traditionally as old and as restrictive as any of the rules on the tabulator of the Meistersingers. A simple hand posture to sustain a mood, to sustain an attitude. The mudra is always the expression of an internal realized truth. And if this realized truth takes a certain form, the hand is placed in a certain posture or is moved in relationship to the body. Now imagine how simple a thing a gesture is. It is about the most elementary motion we can make. And yet the simple fact that we place the hand in the symbolic posture of an idea will support that idea a hundredfold simply because physical action has been brought into harmony with purpose. The individual has done something. And the simple control of his body so that the mind causes action is most important, because no attitude, no inner conviction, no belief, no vision, no inspiration is complete until it is geared to action of some kind, either real or symbolical. So the shoemaker with his last gives the action, and the song of the master singer is the psychic overtone which, united with that action, produces the compound of inner and outward activity meeting. And this compound is the secret of the vital perpetuation of life. Life cannot be perpetuated by thought alone, nor by action alone, nor by feeling alone. But when thought or feeling move into action, there is life, there is activity, there is a vibration set in motion that can never end. So these two levels became part of the German folk. And it is true in other nations also. The musical instruments involved, whether in China, India, Greece, or Egypt, are always designed from one of two things, either the human body or the mathematical formula of the universe, one or the other. The veena, the magnificent instrument of the gods in India, contains within its proportions and dimensions the whole structure of the solar system. So does the simple little moon lute of the Chinese. The Orphic lyre is also the solar system with its planets. And all of the instruments that are used in music are mathematically based upon universal law, because without such law there can be no harmony. So harmonic sound, harmonic interval, has a tremendous ministry in itself, because it relates to the vibratory principles of the universe. The individual who can compose and combine melody and lyric has a knowledge subconscious within himself that is very important to him, and has an experience from this union which is the same as the marriage of the sun and moon in the mystery of alchemical transmutation. Therefore, the sun and the moon, the music and the word, combining together, give life. All of these principles were originally part of music. And if you'll go back to the Greeks, you will realize that in their time, the laws of music were so strictly and rigorously held that the state could pass rulings upon them. Any musician or composer in Greece was required to list his composition with the archons or the judges of the city. The music, when played, was judged by the masters of the music arts. And if this musical composition was regarded as detrimental to the security of the state, the composer could be exiled and the music could be forbidden to be played upon pain of punishment, even to the degree of death. The Greeks were taking no chance with bad music. They simply did not believe in it. Pythagoras, wandering through a Greek city, was able to strike the keynote of architecture with his lute. And Pythagoras believed and taught that every piece of structure that man raises, from a three-legged stool to the most elaborate cathedral, is actually a musical composition. That it can be transformed into sound equivalent, can be played. And an antipathetical chord can be found, which if struck, will destroy the whole building, bringing it down as the trumpets brought down the walls of Jericho in the biblical story. Caruso, of course, was able to break a tumbler by singing its keynote. And there have been many such experiences recorded. But the Greeks believed definitely that in the musical modes there was an entire universe of knowledge, that these modes could change the moods and characters of human beings, that there were modes for healing, that there were modes for religious ceremony, just as there was architecture. In Greece, the temples of each order of deities were different architecturally, and no deity of one order was worshipped in the building of another, because it was declared that the veneration pattern created in the mind of the worshipper, if it was not in harmony with the architecture of the building, destroyed the pattern of reverence. These people were very particular about such matters. The same was true of their music. There was music for every occasion, as there is with primitive man. And today there are hundreds of drum rhythms in Africa, a drum rhythm for every mood of the human soul. And as these drums are beaten, the actual heartbeat is altered. And by changing the heartbeat, we change the rhythm of the drum of Shiva, the great musical instrument of India. for they believe that the pulsing of the heart is the basis of all drum rhythms. Because under various moods, the heartbeat changes, as the Chinese know. And from these simple observations, our entire theory of drum rhythms developed. Also now we know that these rhythms can in turn react upon the heart. And we wonder sometimes what certain kinds of modern music will do. Can we assume that these tonal patterns, harmonic and anharmonic, with which we are constantly confronted, have no effect upon us? The Greeks would have said, these musical compositions can build and destroy a culture. They can create a world or tear it down because of their effect upon the subconscious psychic life of the individual in the realms of vibration. So these sciences were taught in the ancient guilds of music. The responsibility of the musician to the world in which he lived. His composition had to be played before an order of his masters. He was not permitted to give music to the world until it was tested, until the masters of his order were satisfied that he had kept the rules of good music and that he was giving nothing that could hurt anyone. The therapeutic value of music in the modern world is being recognized. Gradually, we shall develop the science of this until we know how to treat a variety of infirmities by this means alone. The Meistersingers did not know this, but they could treat one infirmity, and they did it very nicely. And that was the infirmity of frustration. They were able to release themselves. They had the glorious experience of finding in their music the power that made them better husbands, better fathers, better sons. That they found a release from the burden and responsibilities of daily living and an open door into a world of creativity where all men are equal and where the beauty and the glory of life can be sung as it is sung by the bird and by all creatures that naturally adore their Creator. So there was great religion, great sensitivity in these musical guilds. And as time went on, they have gradually disappeared from among us. And in their place, we have what we call the art of music today. This art of music has no murka. It has no rules. It has gone from the overburdening of laws to the absence of laws. Today, each individual who is an innovationist believes he is a creator. But somewhere there should be a murka. Perhaps a little wiser and better one than Beckmesser, but still someone or something that reminds us that with sound we create and with sound we destroy. With sound we pick up the sorrowing heart. With sound we tear down the strength of nations. With sound we can heal neurosis. And with sound we can create neurosis. With sound we can produce brainwashing, as it is produced in Russia. With sound, we can lift man up to the elevation of an apotheistic condition, as in the celebration of the High Mass, and in some of the magnificent compositions that we know in the world of great music, such as, for instance, one that I particularly like, and that is the Mass of Palestrina. These musical things, these wonderful tonal patterns and pictures, tell us of the secret tradition in music and how the musicians themselves, instinctively or otherwise, seem to touch and move in upon a world of unseen powers and values. In Wagner we have one of these tremendous creative forces. We have in Wagner perhaps one of the most amazing unfoldments of the music of the people. The sense of music as the stirring power of the traditional soul in man. In Wagner, music releases through man the old, the deep, the ancient, the folk in himself. It brings to the surface of him the legend, the fairy tale, the myth, and the allegory. It brings forward out of the ancient atavistic life he has lived the long, strange, locked story of himself. In Wagnerian music, the subconscious, the unconscious part of man, suddenly merges toward the surface. It unlocks strange, deep mysteries. Perhaps this is one of the reasons it has had such a strange, almost demoralizing effect upon German consciousness for a long time. But it also unlocks the temples and gates of the old mysteries. It brings back the pageantries of long ago. It establishes the leitmotif theory, which is the one in which every value in life has a musical design. And from these key designs, every great melodic compound and harmonic compound is built until we are confronted with the universe itself as a magnificent symphonic composition composed of all the motives of every living thing blended into one magnificent choral mass. All these things we sense in Wagner, and we sense that perhaps he was an heir to the ancient troubadours. There is much to indicate that he knew their technique and their work. Perhaps he also was singing to his invisible and unknown mistress, the Virgin of the world. And he restores the old ways. He is the one great geographical misfit in music. He does not belong in that great unfoldment of the three B's that we hear so much about. He belongs rather in the strange medieval pageantry of an age of chivalry or an age of mysteries and rites and ceremonies. And through his music, some of the greatest surviving rituals of music drama are preserved for us. And in these, we are very grateful to him. But we must not be overwhelmed by him. We must also recognize that in this torrent of release, there must be organization. What each individual must do is realize that if he ever opens the strange Pandora's box of his own internal, he must be prepared with skilled hands and an open mind to use this power. He must have creativity. For release from within himself must have skilled creativity to direct it. So every man must, before he seeks to grow and know, must have the skill in his hands, the skill in his mind, the dedication in his heart, to use what pours through him constructively. If he does not do this, then he definitely perverts or misuses the tremendous resource that he has. Operas tell us much of this. The opera experience is something for the thoughtful. It is not true that music is for privileged classes, nor for leisure classes, nor for a few connoisseurs or musicologists. Music is for all men, and those need it most whose other outlets are most limited. And in the gradual growth of music appreciation within the consciousness of man, we have one of the most maturing, enriching forces operating in society today. And this is about all we can do with our little series of five talks. We hope they have been helpful, that you have enjoyed them, and we take this opportunity of wishing you all the season's greetings in case we shouldn't see you again until after Christmas. And thank you very much.